A lot of work goes into the production of new variations of plants, and some of that work is being done at the UW-West Madison Agriculture Research Station. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk. With me is Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County and one of our favorite guests. Are you familiar with the agriculture research stations across the state? What gardening questions do you have for Lisa? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Just look for Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we always like to see your garden photos, so post a few of those. So, Lisa, thanks for coming in today.
Sure. Thanks for asking.
You bet. Now, can you tell us exactly what this agriculture research station is?
Well, the agriculture research stations in Wisconsin, and there are more across the nation, concentrate on working with the universities to conduct agricultural research. And across the country, they may work on things as varied as colony collapse with bees. They may work on new vegetable varieties. They work on citrus crops. It spans everything from livestock to insects to fruits and vegetables. And our research station here in the Madison area is called the West Madison Agricultural Research Station, and they do work with researchers at the UW in the area of agriculture, and they also have some wonderful display gardens that help to show different varieties of both flowers and vegetables.
And we do have a picture on our Facebook page.
Yes.
That they were able to supply us, which you can see. I mean,
yeah.
It's beautiful. Absolutely. Now, I had mentioned before, we do have like 12 across the state. So
mm-hmm.
Do each have a specialty?
Often they do. The Peninsular Research Station does more with fruits, being that they're close to the cherry-producing area in the state.
Sure.
Here at the West Madison Ag Station, it's more agronomic crops and vegetables. They do a lot of organic work, but they have a really great grape testing program. They're testing some for table grapes and also for raisins. So really exciting research taking place there.
Yeah, I saw that with the raisins. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
We think California when we think raisins, but is there a reason why we couldn't grow them here?
Well, there are some varieties that are not hardy here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of why we do this research, is to find out what varieties grow well in our area. There is a grape grower association here in Wisconsin. We have a thriving wine industry. So part of what they're doing there at the West Madison Ag Station is testing some varieties for use as table grapes and wine grapes. Couple of the varieties that they're looking at are Himrod, which is a green grape. Somerset, Einset, Reliance are all reds. And then they're looking at some blue grapes as well, including Montreal Blue.
And where exactly is the egg station here in Madison?
It's out on Mineral Point Road. It's close to the Junction Road intersection,
okay.
Cross from Menards if you're from the Madison area. So its address is technically in Verona, but it's pretty close to the outskirts of Madison.
So how big is it? It must be very large to handle all of this.
You know, I'm not sure how many acres it is, but it's substantial, yeah.
I think I had read somewhere that was over 500. Does that sound right?
That could be.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. And some of the studies that they've been doing are, you mentioned the grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some other things, too. One that caught my eye, which I thought, I don't know, for some reason was funny, but it's carrots and making their tops bigger. Can you talk about that? Do you know anything about that particular research project?
I don't know anything about that particular research project, but they are doing all kinds of research with carrots. You know, different colors of carrots have different pigments in them, which provide us with different nutrients. So there, we do have a very active carrot breeding, onion breeding research on campus, so it's not surprising that some of that would show up at the West Madison Ag Station.
And I think the study was the tops are bigger so that they don't have as many weeds. They discourage the weeds.
Well, that would make sense. Mm-hmm. That carrots are one of those crops like onions that you tend to get more weed problems because you don't have as much canopy to shade the soil.
Sure. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Our lines are open, so please give us a call if you have a general gardening question or if you want to know about the egg stations. Lisa can help you out with that. Now, Lisa, I know that the egg stations encourage people in the community to come and visit, and I know there's some events coming up.
That's right, there are, and there's an event coming up on Saturday, August 20th. It's their annual open house day. Now, you can come visit them any day of the year, but they have this annual day where a lot of our specialists come in from the university and are there to answer questions, and they also usually are serving food, some of the crops from the research station. I know in the past, Jim Nienhuis has been there roasting peppers. I'm not sure he's going to be there this year, but you know, there's usually like tomato tasting and a lot of fun things like that. They're usually, you know, it's a great activity for families to come out and visit. Some of the specialists that are going to be there are PJ Leash, who's our entomologist, the director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll have Johanna Brene, who's going to be talking about pollinators. Brian Huddleston, otherwise known as Dr. Death, one of Larry's great guests, is going to be there from the Department of Plant Path. He's the director of the Plant Diagnostic Clinic. Sarah Patterson will be there for questions about table grapes, wine grapes. Our specialist, Amaya Atuka, will have turf grass specialists there. Julie Dawson, one of our vegetable systems specialists, is going to be there. She talks about urban settings and growing vegetables there. She's also doing some research on breeding vegetables for better taste and for more intense taste, which is really exciting. The master gardeners are going to be there to answer garden questions, so it's going to be a great event.
It does sound like a great event.
Yeah.
Now, when does
it's a lot of fun.
Do you know the
that
hours?
That is from 10 to 2 on Saturday, August 20th at the West Madison Ag Station, 8502 Mineral Point Road.
Okay, so that's coming up fairly quickly.
It is, yeah. Not this, Saturdays?
Three Saturdays, yeah. I think, yep. Yeah. They told me I didn't have to do math on this job, so I'm just going to guess. So that, and also there's information on their website. So
absolutely. Yep.
They can go there and get, and there's one other thing that we wanted to mention. There's a new event real quick.
Yeah, and it's a fundraiser that's coming up in September, the 24th of September. I don't have the hours on that, but you can check their website or give them a call at the station. And it's going to be called, it's the Cut and Dig, and they're inviting you out to take cuttings of some of their annuals that they have. And, oh, they have everything from, you know, coleus to Coreopsis, and
sounds like a really neat event.
Right.
Our gardeners are going to love that.
Yeah. So. And you can also take divisions of their perennials. So the I've been told all the prices are going to be under $5, so definitely save some space in your garden this fall.
Great. Thanks for that update, Lisa. Let's go to the phones. We've got Cheryl in Madison. Hey, Cheryl. What do you have for Lisa?
Well, I do the urban gardening. I was listening to your thing about the open house, and I think I'll go.
Great.
I have two 4x4 beds that I've gardened in organically for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And last week, Dr. Death diagnosed one of my plants is having bacterial canker.
Oh.
And I caught it quickly enough because I saw the spot. And he told me, you know, it's best not to plant there for 3 years.
For what species?
For the bacterial canker in my tomatoes.
Okay, in tomato. All right.
And you know, when we do a little 4x4 raised bed, we can't really do crop rotation.
Yeah, but
we take our garden out, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do this fall to help amend that soil so I don't lose garden space.
Well, about the only thing that you could do is remove all the soil, disinfect the bed, and put in new soil. Either that or think about growing your tomatoes in a pot, maybe for a season or two. That is a problem when we do square foot gardening or raised bed gardening, is that we do get a buildup of pathogens. And particularly when you've been gardening with different species all in the same bed, not just plants from the same family, like if you grew your tomatoes and your peppers and your eggplants all in one bed 1 year, and then you grew, say, beans and lettuce, which are in a different family, in a different bed, and you know, you were able to do some rotation that way. But when you mix plants from different families and grow them in the same place every year, you do get a buildup. And so it's not surprising. I'm actually surprised that it took that long to start having an issue. But it is a soil-borne pathogen, so you know, taking out the soil would probably be your only option.
Okay. Well,
probably not what you wanted to hear.
I wouldn't imagine. Well, good luck with that, Cheryl. Let's go to Annabelle in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Annabelle.
Good morning. I have two questions. My first one relates to shallots. I have not grown them before, and I dug mine out and was surprised to see that they were at all little sections in them. And my question is, could I save or use some of these sections and plant them in the fall, hoping to get a early start for them next spring?
So are you talking about cloves when you say?
Well, they're sections. They tend to look a little like the divisions on the garlic.
Okay. I personally have not grown shallots myself, so I you've actually stumped me on this one.
Wow.
I'm not sure whether you can do that or not. You can. I'm just trying to think. I know we have a publication on growing onions, garlic, and other Allium family crops. So I will look for that answer during the break.
Okay,
and
sounds good.
Get back to you on that.
Okay.
You had another question, though, right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah, the other question deals with gladiola corms.
Oh, yes.
My rabbits chewed off the tops of at least four and probably six.
And I
know where I had them, and they are down to ground level. So this morning I thought, well, I'm going to go and dig while I know where I planted at least four of them.
Right.
I got them out of the ground. And I could see a little bit of the stem that was still under the ground, but I think I'll just put them out and let them dry. Is there any hope that they will do anything another season?
Yeah, you know, it's late enough in the season that they may not bloom a lot for you next year, but they've probably stored enough carbohydrates from photosynthesis that they will come back again. But do store them, you know, properly. They may actually, unless you get them into cold storage right away, they may actually try and resprout.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Annabelle. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She's from UW Extension, and she's taking your gardening questions. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And I see that Dean on Facebook said that he has a very strange rot on all his creeping Charlie that is wiping it all out.
That would make most people happy.
I was going to say that's a problem. Okay, it turns brown and then mushy, and it seemed to catch on one of his herbs, but doesn't seem to be bothering the grass or any other garden plants. Any idea what this possibly could be? The areas are in a huge patches, with some being over 20 feet long.
That sounds like a dream come true.
Well, if you could bottle that and sell it.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting that it's only affecting the creeping Charlie. Did he say he has a picture with it?
Yeah, I guess there's a picture. I'm not sure where it is, but we'll try to take a look at
that. There's a nice one of the Ag Research Station.
Yes, there is. Well, I am not doing a good job of getting that. There we go. I don't see it.
Okay.
But do you have any idea what that could possibly be?
I was thinking perhaps it might be some kind of slime mold or something like that, since he said it seemed to catch on to one of the herbs. But usually that will overrun grass as well.
Yeah, there we've got the picture, but...
See a whole lot of
It looks like the creeping Charlie is dead and there's grass popping through it.
Interesting.
Strange.
You need Dr. Death.
I was going to say, I think Dr.
Send
Death
him,
needs to
send
be involved.
Him a sample.
Mm-hmm. Where can they get a hold of him? Just UW Extension,
sure.
Right?
Sure. If you just Google PDDC and then UWEX, that will get you to the clinic website. That's for Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And you can either talk to Brian or one of his staff. You can email him that photo. He probably, though, would need a sample to actually diagnose what pathogen that is and grow it out in the lab. A lot of the pathogens, either the symptoms look very similar or you know, when something is rotted to that degree, usually you need to grow it out in the lab.
Sure.
And see what the spore structure is.
All right. Well, Dean, I hope you do that and let us know. It would be interesting to find out. So let's go back to the phones. We've got Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just calling. Last week at the very end of the show, there was a listener that called in problems with her wave, or also called super petunia baskets, yellowing, whatever. What you got to do with those is, I've found out through experience,
you got to
fertilize. There's a
real
good product on the market. It's called Jack's Classic Petunia Feed. And what he did, I've talked to him a few years back, when he formulated that feed, he's got chelated iron in there. And it's mostly for the super or wave petunia baskets, because they go downhill so easily. It's a formulation of a 20, a 6, and a 22. And it works wonders. And I've noticed, too, that some of the big box stores, because of the type of what they're planted in, some of it's pretty, it dries out so quickly.
Yeah, they usually use a soilless mix so that if people are overwatering, it's not an issue.
Right. And what was the name of that again, Lee?
It's called Jack's Classic Petunia Feed, or Jack's Special Petunia Feed, whatever.
Great.
And it comes like in a little a 1.5-pound container, it's a blue powder.
Sure.
But it really does wonders for your super or wave petunia basket.
Great. Well, thank you for calling back again, Lee. We really appreciate that. I remember you calling in last week, so thank you.
Petunias are one of those crops that are heavy feeders.
Right.
And so they do, and especially when you have them in a restricted root area like a pot, you do need to make sure that they receive enough nutrients. And this time of year, when they've taken up all the available space
right.
with root mass, fertilizing becomes important too. Although if it's really hot outside, you might want to pull back on it a little bit.
Right. Now, are the wave petunias, do they have some kind of special needs more than regular?
Well, they are a lot more vigorous, so they're just growing faster, and so they might need it. Yeah.
Great.
But petunias in general are heavy feeders.
Okay. Well, let's go to Sarah in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. I know you're supposed to trim your lilac bushes right after they flower in the spring.
Right.
But I didn't. Is it too late to do it?
This is not a good time of year to do major pruning on any shrub. Usually they say about the 1st to the 15th of July is the very last time that you should do it, because you can start to initiate new growth that then doesn't harden off properly in fall. This time of year is kind of, I think of it as the prelude to getting ready for dormancy. So you'd be better off right now, either waiting until the plant is dormant or doing it next spring. The good news is that gives you some free time this weekend, right?
There you go. Now, if she does it in the spring, though, she has to make sure she does it after
right,
they bloom.
After they flower, mm-hmm. Yeah, because the flower buds are set right now for spring. That's another reason not to do it at this time of year, because you might get rid of a lot of your floral show.
Right, great. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Elsa in Milwaukee. Hi, Elsa. What do you have for Lisa?
Hi there. This is my first year actually planting tomatoes.
Oh, nice.
And I had tried once before, and it just grew 12 inches maybe, and it died. So this year, I made sure that I got proper soil, fertilizer. I did everything by the book. Now I've got these tomato plants that are just growing crazy, but they've got tiny little tomatoes, and I'm just afraid of what's going to happen, because these plants are so huge. Can I prune back some of these leaves? Because these things are just huge.
Do you have an indeterminate variety, do you know? Is it a cherry-type tomato? Is that why the tomatoes are small?
I don't know. Actually, the three plants that I planted were all given to me.
Okay.
One is called Yellow Boys, I think it's called.
Okay.
The other one is Gregorian something or other.
Okay.
And that one's got these huge, you can tell that those are going to be big.
Okay.
But, and then the other one, I forgot the name of the other one. I lost the little tag.
Okay. Well, Yellow Boy is a kind of medium size tomato. The Gregorian one, I've never heard of that one before. But what I'm suspecting for the teeny tiny tomatoes is that they may be cherry tomatoes. And a lot of the cherry tomato plants are very vigorous. They do get very, very tall. They keep growing all season long. And so these are the types that would grow sort of a grape-sized tomato that you use on your salads, although you can use them for other things as well. When you say the one that you think is going to be big, I'm wondering if that's an heirloom or a slicer or a beefsteak type. Depending on the type of tomato that you have, as you've noticed, there is a definite difference in growth type. What we call determinate tomatoes are usually the pace type tomatoes or the Roma type tomatoes or patio types that will grow to about 3 or 4 feet, produce all their tomatoes at once, and you're totally inundated with tomatoes and you're frantically making sauce and freezing and everything like that. And then we have the indeterminate types that bear heavily, but they will keep bearing throughout the season. And those are the types that tend to get a lot bigger. What I would recommend is, you know, if you do have to prune them back a little bit, You can do that, but I'd rather have you try and stake them so that you can get as much productive area out of them as possible. So you may need to get some taller type fence post stakes and tie them up. But yeah, I've talked to a few master gardeners this year who's saying, oh my gosh, my tomatoes are usually 6 feet or 8 feet this year. So we've had a really good year with the rainfall, and the tomatoes are going great guns.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Elsa. I hope you get some good tomatoes out of there. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We've had a couple of people asking questions about potatoes, Lisa. Fred on Facebook wanted to know how he can tell when his potatoes are ready to harvest.
Well, usually when the potato vines start to wilt and turn brown, that's usually the time that your potatoes are ready. Now, some people will harvest what you call, the new potatoes a little bit earlier, but usually that's how you figure that out.
So when you're talking probably more into September that they're ready, or could they be ready now?
Yeah, you could probably dig up some now. What you might want to do, Fred, is take a look at a couple, see what they look like. Depending on when you planted them, they may be ready in the next few weeks here, but it may be more towards the end of August or early September.
He's probably getting hungry for those new potatoes.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah. So we had another potato question. Melissa Joe said through email that she planted Yukon Gold potatoes this summer, and the ones in the beds are wilting, and the ones in the compost bin are still green and strong, and they bloomed about 2 weeks ago. When should she dig those up, and what's the best way to store them?
Okay. Why you have the difference between the compost bin and the bed, I'm not sure. I'm a little suspicious when you say that they're wilting. I'm hoping that isn't a disease. I know you didn't say that they're turning gray and fuzzy, but wilting can be not a good sign. So I would take a closer look at those and see if you see any fungal type symptoms. As far as I know, we haven't got late. Well, there is a, let me take that back. There is a possibility that we have late blight in Adams County here in Wisconsin. That's the only late blight potential report I've heard in the state. But since we've had all these storms go through, the potential is there for late blight, and that does cause extensive wilting and fast. So if you see gray, black areas, I would first of all contact Dr. Death and let him know that's what you've got going on. But since you say the one in the compost bin is still green, that's why I'm kind of wondering if it is a disease. So ours in the teaching garden bloomed a couple of weeks ago as well. Again, look for the vines to start dying back. Now, maybe what's happening is just normal senescence, and for some reason, I don't know where, it doesn't say where you're from.
No, we don't know where she's from.
So if she's from a bit south of here, it's possible she's got, I don't remember whether Yukon Gold starts to ripen earlier than others or not, but that may be that it's just happening on its own timetable and that it's perfectly normal. So usually when the vines start to turn brown and die back, that's the time to do it. We have a great publication on potatoes at the Learning Store site that can give you more instructions on how to store those potatoes, but basically the key is keeping them cool and dry, and usually you want to lay them out on a screen to dry and then store them.
Is dark important also?
Yes, dark. Thank
okay.
you. Dark
yep.
is very important. You don't want them to sprout. You also want any chlorophyll that's in the tubers to decay, because you can eating green potatoes is not a smart thing to do.
No,
it can give you some stomach
problems.
It
certainly can. All right. Well, good luck, Melissa Jo. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Dan in Reed. Hi, Dan. What's your question?
Oh, it's just a couple of statements that I want to make. One is about tomatoes. I had like 300 tomato plants, overwhelmed with tomatoes. But anyhow, I let them go for 1 year, and they fell onto the ground and went through the cycle through winter. And the next year, I had a million.
I bet you did.
And they were all cherry tomatoes.
Yep.
Stiff beefers. So that was for your prior caller that was saying something about cherry tomatoes, and that's exactly what happened to me. And also, you were talking about potatoes. My father was a grower himself.
Oh, really?
Yes. And what he did when the plants started flowering,
mm-hmm.
he would stomp them down, and that would put all the nutrients into the potato. So I'm just going to leave you with that to wrestle around with.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan. Let's go to Jan in Rhinelander. You've got another question about potatoes.
I do. It's a very mysterious question.
Oh, boy.
I planted about an 8-foot row of potatoes, and I put them in a different spot because last year I had scab really bad.
Oh.
And they were doing really great. The vines were real tall, and I healed them, and I put grass clippings around them because I mulch my garden with grass clippings, and I have about an 8-foot fence around it so the deer can't get in it. And all of a sudden, I don't know why I didn't notice this, but all of a sudden I noticed almost the whole row was gone. The vines were completely gone. Nothing there.
Wow.
And you could see the dirt, you could kind of see the little indent, you know, where the vines were.
Did something
eat
it? And
I had maybe 2 plants left, and they looked really bad, like yellowish. So I took my fork and I dug where those other potatoes were. There was nothing there, not a root, not a small potato, nothing. It was like I never planted anything there. And I went online and kind of researched it, didn't find anything. And I'm like, where in the world did these beautiful potato plants go to?
Huh.
And I didn't see a bug.
Did you see any scat from an animal by chance?
No.
Okay.
No
deer hoof prints or I don't think they really eat those.
No, nothing else in the garden was touched, and that's why I'm thinking I don't really have a problem with rabbits. And I'm thinking I don't really think it was an animal, because wouldn't they have eaten other stuff? I mean, it's like a mystery. It's like all of a sudden they were gone.
Do you have any hungry neighbors?
No.
Huh.
Well.
You know, and the weird thing is there's nothing underneath them, and I was going to dig the one plant that was left, and I thought, well, if there's potatoes underneath it, I want them to at least develop a little bit. They didn't get blossoms at all. They hadn't gotten to that point yet.
Uh-huh. Huh.
So, yeah, it's a mystery.
I got nothing.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes in your neighborhood, give him a call, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, usually it's either insects or animal pests or disease, and either way, there should be some evidence left.
Yeah.
Aliens?
That's a good answer right there. Okay. Well, Jan, good luck. We don't have an answer for you, so if you find out, let us know.
It's a good day for stumping the hoard agent.
Okay. Thanks, Jan. Appreciate your call. Mary, let's go to you. You're in Dubuque.
Yes.
What can we help you with?
I was wondering about, we have got these beefsteak tomatoes, and is it okay? I put hay under that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's okay, right?
Yeah, that's actually a great thing to do, because a lot of our tomato foliar diseases that are caused by fungi, those fungi are soil-borne organisms. Mm-hmm. So by putting that hay there, you're actually creating a physical barrier between the soil and the leaves, so that when water splashes up with spores on it, that, you know, it's going to prevent that from happening. So we actually do recommend doing that.
Okay, but we got so much rain, and then a couple of the tomatoes underneath got kind of mushy and died.
Okay.
So I was wondering, is it okay to tie them up?
You know? Should tie them up. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Tomatoes should be tied up. The better you can keep them off the ground, the more productive they're going to be and the less prone to disease. And you can even pinch off some of the bottom leaves so that you don't have disease coming up from the soil.
Okay. Good luck with that, Mary. Let's go to Joe in Jefferson. He's got a little different question for us. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have an area where I had like a tree stump around and I put some grass seed in, and then all of a sudden, crabgrass overtook it. I got on my knees, pulled all the crabgrass out, and I put down new. Used the Scott's lawn soil, and and I put down more seed, and it came back again. So then I just took the weed whacker to all of it and hit it with crabgrass killer. I haven't replanted seed yet, but the reason why this ties in is the general question is I have another area that I did have success with, and on the seed it says do not use weed killer 90 days before or after planting the seed, which sounds ridiculous. The summer is only 90 days, you know, you think of it that way, but it worked. But 2 weeks, 3 weeks prior to the area I had success, I didn't use weed killer, but I used what I figure is even worse, which is vinegar and Roundup to kill everything that was in that spot. And 3 weeks after that, I had success planting, and then a few weeks after that, green grass that is real hardy now. So I don't know if that's the same as weed killer, but it worked after 3 weeks. It kind of defied the direction. So I guess I have two questions then. What about using any chemicals and then going against the directions and planting, you know, much sooner than they recommend? And two is, in general, when weeds are popping back up, should you use chemical, you know, weed killer? And if so, how long to wait?
Okay, so first of all, what kind of, you said you used a crabgrass killer? What kind of product was that? Was it a spray?
Yeah,
or
it was made by Bayer. Yeah, and it hooks to your garden hose, and it just automatically dilutes the right amount, and you spray it.
And it's only supposed to kill crabgrass?
Yeah. Well, as you know, with lawns, like step one of four of, you know, the whole seasonal process, the first step, which I never did, was crabgrass. And I actually realized 50% of my lawn in the backyard is all crabgrass.
Yeah.
I didn't know what crabgrass even was.
Crabgrass is an annual species, and usually what's used is a granular product at the time that the forsythia is blooming that keeps the crabgrass from germinating. If you put it on too late, though, and you're seeding other things, you're going to inhibit them from growing as well. So I'm not familiar with the particular product that you're using. Usually we don't want to put weed control products on when something is just starting to get rooted, because it is more vulnerable to damage. So that's why they have that particular recommendation. If it's only a small area, now you did mention your whole backyard, and actually fall is a great time for seeding. So what I would do is right around Labor Day, do some overseeding, and then in the spring put down your crabgrass control. Because at that point you'll be wanting to control the seeds for that year. So does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it's just the main thing I was saying is I ripped, it's coming back so strong. I guess you could say for a little area,
yeah,
get on your hands and knees and just manually pull weeds out as they come in the new lawn.
Right, yeah, that's certainly a great organic way to go. And in a small area like around your stump, that's what I'd recommend rather than using a chemical product. But you have to realize that when you took out the stump and you ground up the soil and so on, you probably brought a lot of weed seeds to the surface, and that's why you saw that flush of seeds. And then when you manually removed a bunch more, that also, you know, stirs up the soil, brings up more weed seeds. So if you had a good seed bank going there for weed seeds, any time that you do disturb the soil, you're going to get that type of flush.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Joe. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. What questions do you have for her? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Garlic Talk. I was just talking about garlic. It's garden talk. We are not specifying garlic today, although it might be a good idea for another show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Our guest is Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. We're going to go right to the phones again. We've got Lucy in Appleton. Hi, Lucy.
Good morning, Lisa and Jill. You made me smile just a minute ago.
Oh, good. Yes.
The reason I'm calling is I've got about three questions, and I'll be quick because I know it's getting close to 12. One thing I've got in my garden this year, it's an orange thread-like tiny vine choking my caraway, cilantro, large leaf basil, and fennel. I've never had it before. I'm completely stymied. I've tried to pull out some of it, the herbs, but it's really difficult to do that, and then I've thrown that, of course, in the garbage. I've got two other quick questions I'm going to mention. What is causing my Caroline ever-bearing raspberries to have chlorosis on the leaves?
Okay.
And the green peppers, I've noticed some blight on the lower leaves.
Yes, okay.
Those are my questions.
All righty. Well, the first one, that orange vine is a parasitic plant. It's a really interesting plant called dodder, D-O-D-D-E-R. And Brian has a fact sheet on it at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. So it's a parasitic plant that penetrates plant tissue and draws its nutrients from them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of creepy that way, I guess. But it actually does flower, but it doesn't have any chlorophyll. And it can be a problem in vegetable and other gardens. So I would what you're doing is the right thing, pulling it out. But do check out that fact sheet. Just Google PDDC and UWEX, and you can find a fact sheet on it at the site. The second question was the chlorosis on...
Raspberries?
Was it raspberries?
Yes, it's on my ever-bearing raspberries, Caroline.
Okay. Yeah, oh, I have that variety, too. My guess is, have you fertilized it at all with nitrogen?
Yes, I do have leaves and some straw mulch around them. Not a great deal. I need to add more. But I did not fertilize them this spring.
Okay. I hate to say do it at this time of year, but is it at the tops or is it at the bottom?
I've noticed it pretty much in the ones I was looking at yesterday, pretty much on most of the leaves. Not all of the canes have it. It's kind of spread among the patch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is the chlorosis, is it yellow with green veins or?
Yes, somewhat like that.
Okay.
Yes, I know it's chlorosis. I know that for sure.
Okay. I'm suspecting it's probably nitrogen deficiency. So you could try, you know, a small application and see whether that helps. Let's see. Okay, this is ever-bearing. The thing is, I'm just not sure at this time of year that it's, you know, we're going right into the bearing season. Have you already got berries on it?
What about if I added some compost to them? Would that be of any help?
Well, the thing with compost is that the nitrogen has to be pulled out of the material by bacteria and fungi, so it's not immediately available. And what I'm concerned about is that, first of all, although organic matter is great stuff, the amount of nutrients that are available, just the quantity, is not as high as you would have with a synthetic product. And so I don't usually recommend an organic product when you have a deficiency. If you've got healthy plants and you want to use an organic product, that's great. You know, you have time. But when you have a deficiency and you need the nutrient right away, it might be better to use a non-organic product, just to get a quicker result. So you could use something, you know, like Miracle-Gro or any 10-10-10 type of fertilizer. I wouldn't put on a whole lot, but if you get an immediate result, then you know what that was the issue, and you should put it on again next spring.
Okay, and then the blight on the green peppers?
Yeah, you know, I've been hearing from people. Actually, I was asking a master gardener last night to send a sample to Brian. I don't know whether it's anthracnose or what's going on, but I have been hearing, and I've seen it on my own peppers at home, that there is some leaf spot. And I'm assuming it's because of all the rain that we've had, so it's probably anthracnose. Which is not going to kill the plant, but is definitely going to take out some of the leaves, and that impacts the ability to produce more fruit. So what I would do is, for a stopgap measure, I would take off any really diseased leaves, try and kind of thin out the canopy, make sure you have good air circulation so the leaf surface stays as dry as possible. And you might want to send a sample in to Brian or give the staff at the clinic a call and see what they're seeing.
Okay, great. Well, good luck, Lucy, on all of those questions. We're going to go to Greg in Wautoma. He apparently has an answer for that potato problem. What do you have to say on that, Greg?
Hey, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not sure where Jan was from. I didn't catch that.
Was she the one with the disappearing potatoes?
Yes.
Okay. We've had so many potato questions, I wasn't sure which one.
So a possibility, which I think would be a strong possibility, if she is somewhere west of the Wisconsin River, we have a species there, the pocket gopher, Geomys bursarius.
Oh!
And it would easily be able to go underneath the fencing that she had, and they're notorious for eating the root structure, and then they pull down the rest of the plant, and you know they put it in their pockets and cache that for a later date as they don't hibernate. And you wouldn't see any evidence of it, and of course they could take away the potatoes as well.
So yep. They don't tend to leave scat then. They don't leave a calling card.
Nope. Yeah, you wouldn't know that they were even there. And I think that would answer the question. But again, they're only west of the Wisconsin River, okay. So that was my answer to her problem. So if Dan's listening, I think she'll know whether that's a possibility or not.
Well, thank you.
All right.
I will have to look that one up.
Thank
pocket
you.
Gophers.
Thank you very much, Greg. That I have not heard of pocket
no.
gophers.
Yeah,
so
that's a new one, too.
Yeah. Let's go to Lucille in Grafton. Hi, Lucille.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a large stand of Stelladora lilies, and they did not bloom this year at all. And I think it's because they're too crowded. Would this be a good time to do some dividing?
Yeah, Stelladora is a daylily, and daylilies can definitely be divided at this time of year. It's usually a pretty prolific bloomer. So is this patch in sun?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, then I suspect you're probably correct. If it's been a few years, dividing it would be a great idea.
Okay. Thank you, Lucille. As far as dividing goes for mm-hmm. that, Lisa, what's the best way to divide up a daylily?
Well, there are a couple of different ways, depending on your preference for doing it. They can be divided either spring or fall. And usually what I like to do is I like to dig up the clump, and then you look for the crowns where the leaves are coming up, and you separate them usually with a sharp knife or a sharp shovel. The other way to do it is if you can see those crown divisions while the whole plant is still in the ground, you can use the kind of nibble at the edges approach.
Okay.
Where you just divide off of the main area. But if you've got something that's really crowded, it's probably best to dig it up and pull it apart.
Should you replant it right away then? Or should
Absolutely.
It,
okay. Yeah, you don't want to let it get dried out, unlike irises where it's a good idea
to let them
the
dry.
Rhizome dry.
Okay. Now, let's just talk real quick again about those two events that they mm-hmm. have over at the Agricultural Research Station that's in Madison.
Right. Yeah, the Open House Horticulture Field Day on Saturday, August 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. They've got booths with wonderful specialists who can help you with lots of horticulture questions. They got master gardeners there answering horticulture questions. They've got food. it's veggies that they've grown in the garden. You can take a look at the vegetables and fruits that they've grown and all of the beautiful display beds. And then there is the event on the 24th of September, the cut and dig event, where you can go out to the garden with your clippers and they will show you plants that you can take cuttings of or that you can divide. So this would be a great time if you want to learn how to divide some perennials to be able to do that with some expert help.
That's a great idea. And their website that you can go to if there's any questions.
Yeah, that's West Madison, all one word, .ars.wisc.edu.
Great. And they have hundreds of different varieties yeah. of things that you can actually look at. There's 100 different kinds of coleus alone, I believe yeah. I saw. It's amazing.
Pretty cool.
Yes, absolutely. Now, next week on Garden Talk, we're going to talk about woody plants and invasive species management. Mm-hmm. So I hope you can join us on that. That's always a really hot topic. And then Monday on the Larry Mueller Show, we're going to be talking about women in Wisconsin history. So hopefully you can join us for both of those. Our guest on Garden Talk today is UW Extension Horticulture Agent Lisa Johnson. I'm Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Larry's taking some much-deserved vacation. So thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. There's more to come. Well, it's Friday, so it must be Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller. Lisa Johnson is in the studio today. She is a Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator, and we're so happy she could join us again. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we're always looking for great photos of your garden. So go ahead and do that. Let's go right to the phones. Barbara in Chippewa Falls, thanks for holding on.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, the fellow who called in about the pocket gophers stole my thunder.
Oh!
The same thing happened to me. My tomato plants were wilted, and I'd pick them up with no roots. And some disappeared, but we figured out we could see in a field pocket gopher. I don't know if they're mounds or whatever, but there was no evidence by. But I hit on a great solution. If you want to do this, I would sit in a, collect my own urine overnight in a bucket, and every morning I would go out and pour it all around the plants. And then they left everything alone, so I didn't lose any more. So if you're a brave person, that would be something you could do to keep these guys away from your stuff. And then I have one quick question. My tomato plants are turning all yellow from the bottom up with dark brown little spots on it. I was wondering if you knew the disease that would be.
There are a number of diseases that look very similar. Are you saying the tomato fruits or the leaves?
No, the plant itself.
But okay. It could be early blight. It could be septoria leaf spot. It could be anthracnose. All three of those are fungal diseases. The early blight and the septoria are both soil-borne. And We do tend to have more fungal diseases, of course, during years when we have more precipitation. The best thing I can tell you to do is make sure to mulch around the tomato plants so that any soil is covered to help prevent the transmission. I would remove any leaves that are affected. You could... I mean, Brian is probably going to need a sample, and it's $20 to grow it out in the lab, so probably for a, you know, $3 tomato plant, you don't want to make that kind of investment. But if this continues to be a problem, you may want to send him a sample, especially if it's affecting all your tomatoes. Do you rotate your crops?
I do, and okay. I mulch with hay.
Okay. That's...
And I know I have anthracnose in the soil because that's been tested before.
Okay. Yeah, I know we're seeing more of that at this time of year, but it also could very well be early blight or septoria. And the early blight has more of the concentric circles in the brown areas. Septoria, the spots are a lot smaller and have kind of purple borders. Anthracnose is a little bit more difficult, but you might have all three, you know. It wouldn't be uncommon.
<Lucky you.
laughs> Yeah, wouldn't be uncommon. So trying to keep the, you know, leaves dry, increase air circulation by thinning them out, removing those dead leaves, doing the mulching, watering at the base, that's... You can also use copper-based products, but once you already have something going, they're not going to be able to cure anything, but they can prevent new infections. So that's a possibility, too, if you're looking for an organic product.
Okay. Thanks, Barbara. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Judy in Madison. Hi, Judy.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yes, I have a tomato question, well, a couple tomato questions.
Mm-hmm.
One of my questions is probably I should have called last week and asked before I did this. My tomato plants are 5 feet tall or more. So a few days ago, I did take the tops off of many of the branches, thinking that if they flowered now, they were never going to get ripe for me anyway. And so my first question is, did I make a mistake by doing that? Should I just continue to let them grow, or was it okay to do it? And the second question is, this late in the year, is it still all right to give them something like Miracle-Gro or whatever?
Yes, you can certainly still give them Miracle-Gro. I would not cut off the tops. It's still plenty early in the year, especially in the Madison area, to still be getting tomatoes forming. You know, if it were September, that would be a different thing, but we've still got a lot of good productivity. What you may find now is that you get more branching and wider plants, because pruning usually will kind of stimulate some new growth. But yeah, usually I would not recommend doing that. But I don't think you've caused any major harm. Tomatoes are very vigorous, and they will probably still be producing for you into September, October.
Okay. Thanks, Judy. Let's go to Stosh in New London. Hi, Stosh.
Good afternoon. I have a flower question, phlox.
Mm-hmm. Garden phlox, the perennial?
Yes.
Okay.
And I like it a lot, so I have a lot of plants of it. But then I think on the garden show just recently, I heard that because when plants are hybridized so much, they don't produce nectar anymore. And the last number of years, I've noticed that butterflies or bees don't do anything with the phlox. So I'm thinking it must be hybridized a lot. So I'm thinking... Are there phloxes that haven't been hybridized a lot, or are there plants that I could get that could replace phlox?
Well, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about phlox in particular. There are a lot of older varieties, like David, for example, that I still see a lot of pollinators visiting. It's possible that, you know, there's some other reason that they're not coming to your flocks. There are other plants, though, that I might recommend using a wild variety. But with the flocks, we have the issue with powdery mildew, and a lot of the breeding that has taken place has been to create plants that don't have problems with powdery mildew. Whether that has also impacted the amount of nectar, not sure. If you're trying to attract pollinators, though, we do have a nice booklet on attracting pollinators to your garden that's at the Learning Store. And you can either order a hard copy or you can look at it online. But a lot of our native wildflowers are great sources of nectar. So you may want to, usually the key is planting varieties. So not just phlox, but phlox and other things like Monarda or
purple coneflower.
Yeah, purple coneflower or butterfly weed or any of the native plants that tend to attract pollinators more.
And I know we had our wildlife specialist on Wednesday. We're talking about the butterflies in particular and that they fluctuate. So
yeah.
Some years are more than others. Mm-hmm. So it could be that it's just a little off year.
That
for your area.
Could be too.
So, okay. All right. Let's go to Eileen in Madison. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's very quick and very easy. I'm just wondering about wild grapevines. They are, of course, very aggressive. But is the fruit edible, and is it recommended even to promote their growth?
I'm not sure what you mean to promote their growth.
I mean, you know, like cultivate them, keep them growing.
To grow them as a crop.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay. I believe the fruit is edible. I've heard of people, you know, eating it before. It tends to not have a lot of flesh on it, though. It's got a bigger seed, so you don't get as big a bang for your buck as you would with one of the cultivated grapes. They are certainly a very aggressive plant, so I'm not sure that you really want to be promoting it. Also, it's a nice trap crop for Japanese beetles if you want to feed the beetles. I guess I'd rather, you know, if I was going to grow grapes, I'd rather grow a domesticated variety. But I can understand if you've already got it, you know, wanting to make use of it. But I know people that use the grapevines for, you know, wreath projects, and they use the grapes for eating, and they even can use the grape leaves for wrapping. I forget what it is. It's a Mediterranean dish,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Not coming up with it right
I am
now.
Not either, but yeah, you can use those. And I know, Eileen, we have them where we live, and we've tried them. They're usually very, very tart.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're gonna,
sugar.
Yeah, you're going to have to use a lot of sugar, so not quite sure if you want to grow those, but good luck with them, okay? Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan in Arlington. Hi, Dan. Talk about Japanese beetles.
Oh, my sympathy.
Yes, we have some grapevines. They started on the grapevine.
Yeah, that's one of their favorites.
Man, we saw them, and we have some basil plants, some trees, pretty much anything to eat.
Yeah, is this the first year you've had them?
I don't know. We just moved there a few months ago.
Okay. All right. I wish I had a magic bullet for Japanese beetles. Persistence is one of the things that I usually tell people about. We've got a fact sheet at the PDDC, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. If you just Google PDDC and then UWEX and look under fact sheets, there's a Japanese beetle fact sheet that will give you some help arm you. I should say that the populations are up statewide this year, probably because of the mild winter. Some of their very favorite things are grapes. They do like basil. They like green beans. They like linden trees, birch trees, roses, hazelnuts, Boston ivy. They have a palette of like 300 plants, but those are some of their very favorites that they like to hang out on. Do not buy the beetle traps. The research shows that that brings in four times as many beetles as you would have had, unless you are in a rural area and maybe you're surrounded by cornfields or something like that. In that case, you might want to put a beetle trap a couple of hundred yards away from your garden. But in an urban setting, because we're so close together, you just end up causing problems with your neighbors, and then your neighbors are mad at you, and you still have the beetles. Usually, because they're around for so long, we don't recommend a whole lot of spraying, because you have to spray about every 7 days. If you did want to try an organic product on your grapes, you might want to try 70% neem oil. That's what they use out at the West Madison Ag Station, because they are all organic out there. And if you want to go out for their field day, there may be somebody there, either Sarah Patterson or Amaya Atuka, who can talk to you about beetles on the grapes. So I feel bad for you. I know that in areas where they are newly arrived, the populations can be just horrendous for about 5 years, and then they start to level out. So that's why I asked you if it was the first year with it. Usually what we tell people to do is do a lot of hand picking. And unfortunately, we, you know, you can use the spray. Maybe what you want to do is use the neem oil and then do some hand picking and kind of alternate with that. If you have kids, you can get your kids involved. So it's a real tough one, because they're around for so long. To get them. If you do beetle picking, try and do it either in the early morning before they're real active. Just go around like I do with my little jar of soapy water and knock them into the soapy water. It does work, mm-hmm. But if you have a large area, it can be a challenge.
And we've had a lot of people call in, and a lot of experts who basically say the same thing. It's almost, and we've heard that birds are starting to eat them, so maybe there's hope
good.
On the
yeah,
horizon.
I know chickens will eat them, but the chickens mm-hmm. are on the ground, yeah. and the beetles mm-hmm. are up on the plants, and the two never yep. shall meet. And
yeah, we had some songbirds, apparently, that have been
oh,
eating them.
Oh, that is great to hear.
Yeah.
Because before hearing that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe they'll find out beetles
okay.
are tasty.
Yeah, let's hope. All right. Well, thank you, Dan. Good luck with that one. Let's go to Irene in Sun Prairie. Hi, Irene.
Hi there. About your tomato diseases, the one thing you're forgetting is don't ever touch those plants with hands or tools that have touched the soil.
Ah, yes, because you can transmit those diseases.
Yeah, and if you're using cages, disinfect the cages with a vinegar spray before you use them in the spring.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good practice.
Great. Thank you so much, Irene, for telling us that, too. Let's go to Linda in Appelstein. Is that right?
Appelstein, yes.
It's Appelstein, okay.
I'm a new gardener, and my plants are growing great, but I've got beets that are about, the green is about 2 feet tall, and I have almost no beet.
Okay.
What did I do wrong that I got so much green and not any beet?
Do you fertilize?
Well, I did at the beginning.
Okay. You know, sometimes if you over-fertilize, you can get more greens than beets, but there are some varieties that are bred to produce more greens because those are eaten as a crop. Do you know what variety you have? Or is it an heirloom or a hybrid?
No, I don't recall. So would I expect to have more beet by now, or are they later in?
Well, usually they're either spring bearing or you plant them about now to get fall. So it could also be it. Did you plant them late?
The middle of May.
Okay, that may be the issue. Well, no. Well, beets can be, they're one of the earlier season crops that you can put in. They're fairly cold tolerant, so you might have planted them a little bit late, but I know it was a cold spring this year, too. I'm guessing from what you've said that maybe try planting them a little bit earlier next year, a couple weeks earlier than that. See if that helps. Also, be cautious with the amount of fertilizer that you put on.
Okay, good luck again, Linda. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Glenn in Wauwatosa. You've got a tomato question, too.
Hi, thank you for accepting my call. I would like to know a question about, I have a question about tomatoes. And it's about what kind of fertilizer would make my tomatoes taste better. I have a real healthy plant, and I want to get the maximum out of this healthy plant this year.
What variety are you growing?
Pretty Girl.
Pretty Girl. Okay, that's a new one, too. I know Early Girl and Pretty Better Girl. And
big Boy or yeah. Better Boy or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, it's a long answer, but I'll try and shorten it as much as I can. The tomatoes that taste the best, and granted, taste is absolutely a
personal
very
thing.
Subjective
yep.
thing,
mm-hmm.
Is that you may want to grow a tomato that has a higher Brix rating or a higher amount of sugar. I'm not sure that using a different kind of fertilizer is really going to affect the taste that much. Usually the taste is more based on the amount of acid that's in the fruit, the amount of sugar that's in the fruit, and the weather allowing the sugars to concentrate. If we have a lot of rain, sometimes you get less of a strong taste. And of course, we can't control the weather. But making sure that you have a balanced fertilizer is, you know, with a 10-10-10 or something like that. Making sure that you have a healthy plant is the best way to get the best taste, and making sure that you have appropriate soil that you're growing it in and a good amount of sunlight. But variety selection, I would say, is probably the best answer, and I'm not familiar with that variety.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll have some really good tomatoes, Glenn. Okay. We had Lee email us and said that she planted garlic last fall for the first time, and she's wondering when she should harvest it. Right now, she has long stems with flowers on the end. The garlic is a hand-neck variety.
Hard-necked.
Hard-neck,
yeah.
Thank mm-hmm. you. And she is in Green Bay.
Okay, so they're a few weeks ahead of us. Ours flowered here probably mid-July.
Oh, wow.
So
that is a big difference.
Yeah, it is. So usually when the garlic is flowering, and I don't remember whether it's a soft neck or the hard neck, that the flower stalk starts to go around in a circle, and that's usually the time to harvest. I would say if they're flowering now, that you can go ahead and start harvesting.
Okay. And to harvest them, you just
pull them up.
Just pull them up.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I have people in our area that are harvesting already. You could probably harvest some of them now and harvest a few more in a couple of weeks since you're behind us.
Okay. And now, do you plant in the fall then?
Yes. First? Yeah, okay. You do plant in the fall.
Okay. All right. And one more time, real quick, let's get the dates of those events over at the Research Center.
Let me tell you, the Veggies for Vets event is coming up next weekend at the Peacefully Organic Farm on, that's the Saturday, August 13th. Saturday, August 20th at the West Madison Research Station is the Horticulture Field Day, and September 24th.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lisa. This is Jill Nadeau sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.